For the week of August 9th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 289, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Austin, Minnesota, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you in Austin, Minnesota?
It's the home of Hormel.
The home of Hormel. I think I know what you're talking about now, because I was in Hawaii last week, and we all know what happens in Hawaii.
What happens in Hawaii?
Okay, now, I don't know if anybody could actually make that out, but that had to have been Monty Python's spam song.
It was. You were in Hawaii, and little did we know, Hawaiians love spam.
Well, I knew that. You were a little shocked by
it. Did you know that before? You didn't know that before you went to Hawaii.
I did know that, yes.
You said you were surprised, and the guy showed you the display and showed you the more and all that.
Oh, I was surprised the very first time I ever went there back in whenever that was. But I was.
Oh, I see.
I was surprised go. That they literally. I thought, okay, maybe it's at this point one of those things that you
eat say, it. But it's not true anymore.
Exactly, that's what I thought. No, it's true. Whole so displays full of spam.
It's linked to World War II, I think.
Yes.
But did you have any spam while you were in Hawaii?
Did
you have the spam sushi, so-called spam sushi, or anything else?
Yes, it's musabi or musubi. I'm probably butchering both pronunciations.
It's what we're best at.
Yes, it's true, actually. I had the fried spam musubi at the kitchen, actually.
How was it?
It was actually quite good. So,
interesting.
Now, mind you, it only had a tiny little bit of spam in it, so...
Did you get any other recipes or try anything else or just that?
I can honestly say no, I did not. Actually, I tried to.
You need to get a Hawaiian spam cookbook and start to whip it up at home and see what you can do.
I have lots of things on my bucket list that might be a little bit further down on the list.
That's true, because you were gone for 2 weeks. You had a good vacation?
Yes. You know, Maui, hey, it's a beautiful place.
It is. And what happened while you were gone? A few things. Jon Stewart said goodbye.
Wait, you mean he's not on television anymore?
Hamilton, the musical, opened on Broadway to raves like you cannot believe. And Fox News debuted a new TV show.
What new TV show did they debut?
They debuted the Republican presidential hopeful debates, because that show, that debate reached 24 million viewers in the overnights. It was the biggest non-sports event in basic cable history. I don't know what happened here. My mind was blown. 24 million people watched the Republican presidential debate. It was unbelievable. It was literally mind-blowing.
Well, you know, they only hyped it for, 6 weeks.
It doesn't matter. That's like, you got to go back to Carter and Reagan for a presidential debate drawing that kind of numbers.
Well,
I mean, it's not even close.
I can tell you that there was, I was actually by the pool at a specific resort in Maui. And in Maui, in Hawaii, of course, it was like 9 hours behind everything. So it was like 2-3 in the afternoon when this debate was happening. And you heard people laughing, like raucous, like as if it were a comedy show. And there was a bar somewhere, and you could hear them like from their hotel rooms and from wherever restaurant they were, and they were actually watching this and laughing.
Well, you got to have your laugh lines. Reagan taught everybody that, it's good to have a little zinger. And it was held at the Quicken Loans Arena, which if I was a Democrat, I would have made fun of that. Oh, you need cheap, quick loans? I wonder why. That was big news. I know Fox News would now like a debate a week, probably. Can we have a debate every week? But Hamilton opened on Broadway. I mean, these were extraordinary rave reviews. It has now $30 million in advanced ticket sales, if not more, since probably 32 or 33 by now. But I've been talking to friends. You have to go back to, as far as a popular hit, certainly Book of Mormon and the producers, but for the combination of like a game-changing Broadway musical that's rewriting the rules or a Broadway show, you have to go back to Rent and to Angels in America, I think, for a show that has had this much attention and praise and commercial box office success. And some people say you even got to go back to A Chorus Line. That's how big this show is.
Well, as you know, Michael, you and I tried to buy tickets for this show for my upcoming visit in September. It's not easy. It's impossible, in fact, to purchase
a
ticket.
Well, you bought them, though.
Yes, although my kids will no longer be going to college.
And finally, Jon Stewart said goodbye. You know how many people watched that in the overnights compared to the Republican debates? 3.5 million people, plus another million streaming. So that's the numbers will rise because that was just sort of the overnights. So it's 4.5 million people. But that tells you something. You know, the show was always bigger than its audience reach, at least in the overnights. And I also think he was saying goodbye at the right time. It's been 16 years. His numbers have gotten a little soft in the last year or two. Clearly, he's on the tail end of his creativity and focus on the show. And they launched a lot of great talent. And he's, you know, he's saying goodbye and people are sad. So I think that means he made a good choice, right?
Well, I don't know about that, but I will say this. You know, that show never really, 3.5 million in the overnights, that never...
That's the second highest ever.
Yeah, but he never really was like, oh, I get 2 million viewers a night. No, he was always like in the million range. So, you know, I don't necessarily... He was pretty steady. He had some major ups.
The last 2 years, they've lost like 30% in the key 18 to 34 demos. They've had some serious erosion in the last 2 years. Which is normal. It's been on for, he's been the host for 16 years, you know, but I don't know what you felt about all the hoopla. Oh my God, he's a combination of Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow and Mother Teresa. He changed America. He's the most, I mean, I found it very annoying and kind of beside the point.
Yeah. And I think he seemed to find it a little bit annoying himself. And also,
I don't think he was annoyed by constant praise and adoration. Why would he be annoyed by that? I thought he handled it gracefully and humbly as much as he could, but he didn't seem annoyed. How dare you say I was wonderful?
Okay,
that didn't
well,
seem to be his attitude.
Maybe graceful is the word I was looking for.
Yeah, he's been a great media critic, absolutely. But that was a source of humor. We are talking about the show and we watched it for 16 years because it was funny, not because he was a media critic, not because he did some nice, important things like helped get a bill. It's because it was funny week in and week out. He was funnier than Saturday Night Live. He was funnier for longer than Dave Chappelle and funnier and longer than Key and Peele and all the millions of other sketch shows that have come and gone and late night talk shows and variety shows. It was funny. That is why the show mattered, not because of him putting the, you know, feet to the fire for CNN.
Well,
what he drew upon for humor and did a really good job. And yes, he was a good media critic, but the main thing is that it was funny. That is why it mattered. And none of that was captured. Everybody had the list of the most important moments of the Jon Stewart show. Virtually none of them were humorous. None of them. It's like, no, you're all wrong. The best moments of the show were like the N-word episode and Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert doing the Steve face-off. Though that's why the show was good. And that's why we watched it every week for 16 years.
The show was on for so long that it made both of them a star. Steve Carell
and lots of people a star. No, like, and again, he created, helped foster a lot of talent in front of the camera, behind the camera. You know, I mean, a lot of people sprang up from that show and you know, like Saturday Night Live in its heyday. That's why it matters.
Now,
but anyway,
what did you think of Stephen Colbert's kind of tribute to him there when he came out last?
Fine. It was perfectly fine last show. He said, you're a wonderful guy, great guy. We learned from you. We love you. Perfectly fine.
Okay, and Bruce Springsteen playing him off?
Whatever. I don't care. It's not worth discussing. It was a fine, happy, low-key send-off like David Letterman, where they put the focus on the staff rather than himself. I think he clearly modeled himself on Letterman there. He was practically note for note the same idea.
Yeah, okay.
You know, which is perfectly fine. Letterman's a god, you know, so why not?
Did Bruce Springsteen play? Because I was in Cannes when this happened. I still have yet to watch the last Letterman show. Did Bruce Springsteen play him off?
No. He had Foo Fighters for various family and personal reasons. The music of the Foo Fighters really matters to David Letterman, and they came onto the show and performed a send-off for that.
Well, apparently, it also matters to some people in Italy. Did you see this thing in Cesena, Italy, where the 1,000 people played? Some guy spent a year trying to get 1,000 musicians and singers together to play Learn to Fly all at the same time, and they filmed it and put it on YouTube. It's gotten 25 million views in under a week. It's a huge viral hit to ask the Foo Fighters to come and play Cesena, Italy. Which,
yeah, it was a YouTube stunt to get the band to come do a show there, and it worked.
It
good
worked.
For them.
They're now going to come and play. So
sure, why not?
Good for them. And it's actually the song sounded pretty good with 1,000 people playing.
Yeah, so you think about who you want to play on our final show whenever that happens 20 years from now. But until then, let us know what we're finally going to talk about this week if we can ever stop talking.
Okay, well, yeah, I guess maybe we should tell people 10 minutes into the show that, you know, what we're going to talk about on today's show. Now, Michael, you know that it is no secret that in the business called show, that this business that we talk about every week, just like in any other industry, money is the fuel that keeps the engine running. Yet, as we'll find out on today's show, raising it and accounting for it and paying it back and doling it out to profit participants, it isn't always straightforward. Indeed, finding fortune and fame in the entertainment business is anything but easy or straightforward. Take Relativity, for example. The upstart movie studio and its brash CEO, Ryan Cavanaugh, were going to change the way Hollywood operated and movies were made. However, now they've filed for bankruptcy. Legendary.
No better path to success than saying we're going to change the way everything works.
Yes, please put a note, you know, put a tab in that for later when you know, you can have your Schadenfreude moment and you can say we told you so. Legendary musician David Byrne, do you like him, Michael?
I do.
Okay, well, he wants record labels to be more transparent about where all the money is going in the music business. I'm not sure why he needs transparency. We all know it's going to the record labels. Even authors are suggesting that the models, that all those business models the publishing industry is based on, be reexamined in the digital age. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the rest of the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, well, in this case, like second or third or fourth, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world, not just North America. We pull our info from RentTrack. We have a link in our show notes. We also look at info from the LA Times, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profits, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is Mission Impossible. $95 million over the weekend, $265 million worldwide. Tom Cruise has never played in the billion-dollar franchise level or 809. You know, most of his movies are not huge, huge movies, but this is his baby. This is his James Bond, and it looks like it's going to be another profitable film. It's going to be at half a billion, $600 million when all is said and done. It's made $108 million in North America, more than that overseas because he's more popular overseas, but he is still a big draw in the U.S. as well. And Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, is that what it's called?
Yes.
Is another, there will be a Mission Impossible 6, clearly.
Well, I mean, you know, we talked, I don't know whether it was the last episode or the episode before that, about what makes a movie star and how they have to kind of rise to fame and kind of fall and then rise again, how that often happens. And, you know, everybody's saying, this is Tom Cruise's comeback. And, you know,
he never went away.
I would say the same thing. I mean, yes, he's done some interesting things there in the mid-2000s where he jumped on couches and was calling Brooke Shields crazy. And, you know, but, you know, ultimately, he's a movie star.
Well, if you make good movies, people will come. Adam Sandler should give him a call. At number two around the world is Fantastic Four. It opened this weekend to $60 million worldwide. It really collapsed here in North America. They were predicting $40 to $50 million. And it's not that their tracking was off. That's what everyone was saying now. It's not that tracking was off. It's that people saw the movie. And if you look at Thursday night and then Friday and then the collapse into Saturday and Sunday, the word of mouth was terrible. Let's say more about this in a few minutes. Let's just do the rest of the box office first, because I think this is the movie we should focus on.
Oh,
and number
okay.
three around the world is Minions, $25 million over the weekend, $912 million worldwide. This spinoff from Despicable Me will surely and probably and likely hit the $1 billion mark. Jurassic World is already there. Another $17 million, $1,580 million. Yes, there will be two sequels.
Yeah, but well, about- and also there'll be a bunch of Legos because, I mean, you go into the Lego store, you go into Target, any of these stores that sell Legos, and every little set that you can buy is Jurassic World this, Jurassic World that. There's like, you know, dinosaur Legos everywhere.
It's so fun watching your kids build little Lego dinosaurs and then watching them eat up all the Lego people.
Yes. As a matter of fact, it's very funny that you say that because I have two daughters in the other room, one of whom is screaming, Papa, tell my sister that her dinosaur can't keep eating my Lego people.
Will there be a sequel to Ant-Man? That's the question. This is the Paul Rudd film, well-reviewed. It made $17 million over the weekend. It's at $325 million worldwide. It needs to hit $400 million for us to roughly think the movie is a hit. You know, this is all, of course, based on the budget that we get reported by third parties and the box office that we get reported by third parties and the, you know, the amount of money they spent on advertising, which we don't know. So it's all, you know, a shot in the dark. But we're going to guess it cost about $130 million to make. And so we think it needs to make about $400 million to be a hit. Well, it got good reviews. It's at $325 million. It will get to $400 million, though probably not much more than that. So it's a modest success for them.
Yeah, well, look, it wasn't a huge failure. So I would say that's good.
and they need Ant-Man to be part of the Marvel Universe so he can appear in some of their other movies. And he probably can't demand the world since the movie wasn't a big hit, but it got decent reviews. And they, you know, they maybe down the road will make a second one because, you know, get a better villain. Maybe you'll make more money. You've established the character. At number six around the world is Monster Hunt, a Chinese adventure film, massive hit, $16 million over the weekend, $312 million, basically in China and a few other small territories. It's the highest grossing Chinese film in China history.
And if you see the poster or the images from this film, there is a picture of a human and whatever this radish looking monster alien thing is. Okay? And the human has one index finger out, reaching toward this alien monster thingy with one finger, and the monster alien thingy is reaching out with its index finger. Where have we seen this before?
I don't know. E.T.
Yes.
Right. Well, it's not an E.T.-type family film, though. I think it's bigger than that, isn't it? There's a lot more action, I think, but I don't know. We look forward to seeing it. Maybe it's playing in New York already. I should check.
Meanwhile, Michelangelo is saying, and where did E.T. steal that from?
Yeah, well, fair enough. And yet, our immediate thought is E.T. At number seven is a South Korean film. It's called Veteran. It's sort of an anti-1% movie. That's what I'm going to dub it as. It made $15 million over the weekend. It's about a cop, a veteran, obviously. And there's this spoiled little rich guy who's a young guy who's inherited wealth and power and money, and he can do whatever he wants. And the veteran cop is determined to bring him down because he knows he's a bad guy. And number eight is Adam Sandler's Pixels, $14 million over the weekend, $130 million worldwide and counting, desperately counting, hoping to keep counting. We'll have to see where it ends up. It's in a lot of territory, $76 million. Clearly, not a good movie, not good word of mouth, not a lot of strong box office. It costs about $80 to $90 million to make. It's at $130 million in counting. We'll see where it ends up.
Well, Amy Pascal says she loved it.
Does she really?
Yeah, she said she thought it was a good movie.
The studio head almost always says they love it, don't they?
Yeah, well, the former studio head, yes.
Well, and the currents, you know, Don't they all say they love the real movies?
I love the movie, yes. And that's why I decided to pull all my advertising from it.
At number nine is Inside Out, the Pixar film. Another $13 million, $635 million worldwide. It's the second biggest Pixar film for North America in history.
Go see that movie.
At number 10 is The Gift, another success story here in North America. It's in six territories, but mostly it opened up and made its money in the U.S. This is a low-budget suspense film, kind of like Fatal Attraction. It cost $5 million to make. We don't know what they spend on it to open it, but it made $12 million over the weekend, and everybody's happy.
Well, I'm happy because I'd like to see STX Entertainment. I'm not necessarily a big fan of the name, but I like Adam Fogelson, who's running the studio, and I'd like to see them do well.
Trainwreck is about to pass $100 million worldwide and still got a lot of overseas to go. Vacation has been not a success story particularly. Certainly terrible reviews, but, you know, how much did it cost to make? You know, Vacation cost what?
I don't know. About
$30 million to make. It's made $30 million, so it needs to make $90 million, but it's only in North America. It's still got the rest of the world to go, and it's made its budget back here in North America. You know, it's grossed its budget. It's made over $37 million. So that's a decent start. I mean, it's a comedy. Those don't always travel well, but it's a dumb, broad, gross-out comedy. You know, when all is said and done, they'll probably make their money. They didn't launch a franchise, but they didn't lose their shirts. Ricky and the Flash opened here in North America. That's the new Jonathan Demme film. He hasn't made a good movie since, Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, wow.
See what winning an Oscar dude can do to you? Good Lord. So Ricky and the Flash made $7 million over the weekend. It's one of the lower openings for a Meryl Streep film, which shows why she's a movie star. She's never had big, big movies except for Mamma Mia, but she's a consistent, strong draw. And, you know, within a certain budget, you're going to make your money. In this case, that may not pan out, but it's not her fault.
Rachel Getting Married.
Yeah, I didn't think that was a good movie.
The Truth About Charlie.
Terrible.
Philadelphia.
Horrible. I said good. I didn't say profitable. Philadelphia made a lot of money. But yeah, no, he made the Oscar with Silence, and then the Oscar, you know, he made lots of noise with Philadelphia, but that's a bad movie that wasn't good at the time, but now it's really dated poorly.
Okay.
But then you're ignoring all the bad movies since then.
Oh, I'm trying to skip over those. They don't make my point.
He made Beloved. Yeah. He has, in fact, he's lost interest in making movies. You know, he was making movies pretty regularly, fun, loopy films. And then he won the Oscar, got all serious and seemed to lose it. You know, this is normal. This is what happens when you're a creative talent. Most artists in whatever medium have about 10 or 15 years where they're at their peak. Whether you're a novelist, a rock star, a painter, a filmmaker, whatever. This is a playwright. This is just how life is. You don't create great works for 30, 40 years. It's not normal. Once in a blue moon, you'll get someone like Picasso or Dylan, and they will do that. But really, it's far more often that you'll see, oh, yeah, that was where they were really on the ball.
You know, there's this guy, Michelangelo, again. He's clearing his throat.
Yes. Again, that's why, you know.
He's the exception.
Even, among people who are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, or even among Oscar-winning, you know, greats, almost always you're going to see a key period where they were really at their best. Not just that the other stuff is really great but not classic. No, there's a key period where they were really good, and then the rest is not so interesting, or they're repeating themselves.
Well, kind of like us for now. This is our period of being really great.
That's right. So that's Ricky and the Flash. Paper Towns, still chugging away. It's now in 50 countries, 49 countries. This is the film based on the John Green novel. It cost $12 million to make. It's grossed $60 million around the world. Is it anywhere near the Fault in Our Stars? No, but everybody's happy. It's making money. And then I want to talk about Shaun the Sheep. This is a movie based on the TV show. It's from the folks of Aardman, who did Wallace and Gromit and a number of really clever, good films. We don't know what the budget is for this movie. All we know is that it's significantly, that was their word, significantly less than the $55 million they spent on a movie called Pirates, which did not make a lot of money. This one is cheaper. It's made $70 million worldwide and counting. It's done really great around the world because it doesn't have any dialogue. So it plays well in China. It plays well in France. It's easy for families and everyone to see the movie and enjoy it. It's just not a silent film. There's music and sounds and all that, but there's no dialogue. So it's easy to, you know, transport around the world, just like the Mr. Bean films. I'd love to know what the budget is for this movie.
Well, I know that it played at a couple of festivals, and everywhere it played, people loved it.
Oh, it's one of the best reviewed movies of the year.
Oh,
absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. It's very well reviewed. I mean, it's not that everybody says it's the best movie of the year, but everybody likes it.
Okay, now I'm going to go see it.
Yeah, well, take your kids. For God's sake, you're taking them to Jurassic World. You should take them to Shaun the Sheep movie. They'll probably say they're too old for it, but it's funny. So tell me about Fantastic Four.
There are four characters in this movie. Mm-hmm. One of them is a rock, and I don't mean the rock. I mean he is a rock, okay? And I don't
He's
mean
Jake
like...
Bell, terrifically talented actor. What went wrong? And I would say nothing went wrong.
What?
Don't you agree? What went wrong? They did everything right. They hired a young director who'd made a cool indie film,
okay.
Right? They took a chance on a young director who'd made a small indie film, just like they did back then with Christopher Nolan in Hollywood. They took Josh Trank, said, oh, you made this cool little movie, found footage, it's clever, it's hip, it's indie, it's geeky, it's superhero-y. All right, we're going to let you roll the dice on this.
And do you want to mention what that movie was?
It's called I Forget.
It's not called I Forget. It's called something else entirely.
I know. I like it. I forget what it's called. Oh, you don't know? Chronicle.
It was Chronicle. That was the movie sure you knew what it was.
Oh, no, I didn't. Yeah, no, it's a clever little movie. I actually liked it. It's not great, but it's a nice calling card. And so they gave him the movie, the franchise. They went back to the source material and said, all right, we made two movies that were sort of family friendly, very, very family friendly for all superhero movies are kind of family friendly. But the first two Fantastic Four films were notably soft. You know, it was about the witty banter between the characters. It was really one you could take little kids to. And that family friendly vibe kind of hurt it. I was down with it because I think that makes sense for the Fantastic Four. But for this movie, they said, all right, we're going to get edgier. We're going to get darker because that's what everyone does, just like Batman, just like everybody else, just like Superman. So they got a cool director. They went back to the source material, tried to put a new spin on the origin story. They went edgier and darker. They got good young actors to play the roles like Miles Teller and Jamie Bell, terrific actors coming off hot property in Miles Teller's case. So I think they did
and
everything
Miles
right.
Miles Teller is Whiplash is what you're
that's
referring
right.
to. Yeah.
So they did everything right. You know, but it just was a crappy movie.
Yeah, well, they did everything right except for the part where, you know, the movie didn't really actually.
Right. They in the planning stages, I wouldn't second guess them.
Yeah, okay. So you're saying on paper, this movie makes money.
No, I'm saying on paper, they made the right creative choices to give themselves a shot of making a good movie. It didn't work out.
Because on paper, now it's got a C-minus cinema score.
Yeah, you know, I looked this up. I thought, oh, big deal. It's got the lowest cinema score ever for a studio superhero movie. First of all, what a stupid, you know, narrow point to make. You know, oh, about for films starring black people in Westerns, it got a terrible cinema score, you know. But so I thought, well, how long has cinema score been around anyway? I mean, I barely remember hearing about them a few years ago. How long have they been around, Sperling? Since 1979.
Yes, exactly.
So they've been around for a long time, haven't they?
Well, relatively, yes.
That's 36 years, Sperling. That's a long time. So, but does Hollywood take this seriously? Because I've never really given a damn about the cinema score. That's just a stupid thing. People didn't even used to talk about it except in the industry. Was it always a big thing in the industry?
Well, I think they talk about it when it comes to an agent saying, come on, my client's last film got an A cinema score. Or, you know, some studio executive saying, look, you know, this movie's great. It's got an A cinema score. Well, like 90% of all movies get an A cinema score. So I don't know
right.
what.
You got to get an A plus. If you get a B, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And anything below a B, you're really in trouble. So yeah, the people who go see movies want to enjoy themselves. They spend $12. You see this on Broadway. People go see a show on Broadway. They're spending $150, $200. They want to enjoy, you know, say, oh, it was good. It was good. Maybe they wouldn't recommend it strongly, but if you're asking them, did they enjoy? Oh, yeah, yeah, it was fun.
Okay,
if you get to go all the time, you're a little harder on it.
Well, let me ask you this. What show are you seeing for $150 to $200? Because I'd like to pay that for Hamilton.
So Fantastic Four had a C-minus cinema score, very low score. Obviously, the word of mouth was dreadful. The worst part of it all was probably Josh Trank shooting himself in the foot.
Oh, God. Yeah. So Josh Trank, and you could just see their agents slapping their heads and immediately picking up the phone. So he basically went on Twitter and said, hey, man, this was not my cut of the movie. My cut. I had a great cut a year ago, and like they totally made me change it. And my cut would have got much better reviews. And that was soon deleted.
Well, it doesn't matter that it was deleted. Yes, he realized he made a mistake. But what the hell was he thinking?
Yeah, he was thinking.
I mean, he made this movie. It was a very troubled shoot. I think other people come in to do the reshoots. I don't even know about that. But he was lined up to make one of the Star Wars movies. Or what was the movie he was lined up for?
Don't
and he got
me.
Pulled off that.
Yeah, I don't
he
know.
He had a big franchise of another franchise lined up. And they dumped him from that project. So then he's got a troubled, bad reputation. This movie doesn't look like it's going to do well. And on opening weekend, he decides to mock his studio and put a bad vibe and bad mojo on his own film on opening weekend. His agent, you say his agent picked up the phone. If I was his agent, I would have picked up the phone and fired him and said, I'm done with you. You know, if you're going to just be an idiot, I don't want to be associated with you because that's deeply unprofessional and stupid and pointless, even if it's true.
Yeah, well, he was, I guess he was indeed on a Star Wars spinoff, which, you know, he was exiting or fired for personal decision to move forward on a different path, is what he said.
Yeah, he was dumped from the project. You can't, you know, I'm sure he wasn't legally fired, but yeah, he was fired.
Yeah, the different path included one without me.
Yeah, so, you know what? He made a good movie. Maybe he'll make another good movie down the road, but he hasn't made his path back any easier.
No, that is true.
Yeah, so Universal, they're having a good year, aren't they?
Yeah, so you're like, hey, let's shift gears. Universal, yeah, good year. Are you kidding me? They've grossed $5.5 billion worldwide at the box office. I don't know if a studio has ever grossed that much money. It's only
Well, no, that's the record. It's the biggest annual gross in history, and they did it by August.
Yes, true.
They still have September, October, November, and December to go. They set the biggest annual box office record worldwide, and they did it in 8 months.
And they still have Crimson Peak, which is Guillermo del Toro's movie, which, you know, people are, the people who've seen it so far, there's a few people who've seen it, and they're saying, hey, this thing could be a real sleeper hit.
Why would it be a sleeper? It's Guillermo del Toro.
Well, because it's not a big
It's going to open big on 3,000 screens with a major studio pushing it every 5 seconds and a big, you know, brand name director. It's not a sleeper.
Okay, fine.
You can't be a sleeper when you're, you know, ooh, Steven Spielberg has a little sleeper hit on his hands. Mind you, I'm way off Guillermo del Toro. I haven't liked his movies in a while, and the excitement for him, I fear, has paled.
What about Straight Outta Compton? Has that paled?
Well, that's opening up this week. That's one of the movies opening this week, and it's from Universal. That's getting very good industry reviews. It's long. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes, but it's getting good reviews. And as always, it will outperform whatever predictions they make for it. For opening weekend, they will say, looks like it'll open to $25 million, and then it'll make $40 million. And they go, what happened? This movie's going to have a very good opening weekend. It's also the soundtrack. The soundtrack is by Dr. Dre. It's now his new official album. You know, he's been working on a new album for like 15 years. Something like that. We've been waiting 15 years for a new Dr. Dre album, and now the Straight Outta Compton soundtrack is going to serve as that new Dr. Dre album. It's out now. I got it on my phone. I can't wait to listen.
Wait, was it pushed to your phone, whether you wanted it or not?
No. I went out and got it.
Oh, okay. Just checking.
That's right. Here's one, and Universal also has the new Jake Gyllenhaal film, Everest. I'm looking forward to that. I'm not sure why they're opening it the weekend that they are.
When are they opening that film?
Well, they're opening it opposite another... You know, adventure. It's either Hunger Games or the other one.
Bad
the
idea.
Divergent. Yeah, and there's a couple weekends that are open right after when it opens. So I don't know about the scheduling. Why these two studios are going head to head? It seems like they're sort of similar. You know, vibes. Not that you know gets good reviews. It's a good movie. It'll have legs. Everybody be happy. But
maybe they're hoping like, hey kids, you go see Divergent. I don't know what it's called. And we'll go see the Everest movie.
Yeah, but no, this is not a movie that you should be pitching to adults. It's a movie for everybody, I would think.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, teens and older, you don't want 8-year-old. Don't take your poor little daughters to Everest and have them get traumatized.
The irony is they want to see The Walk.
Well, sure. No, that's appropriate, I think. I mean, I don't know about the dialogue and whatever as far as whether it's an R or PG-13. But no, that's cool. I'm glad they want to see The Walk. I'm really excited to see that, even though, again, Robert Zemeckis, his peak period was a long time ago.
Yeah, this is a whole show about people who are past their peak.
Well, most people always are. So Variety had a weird comment, and they're past their peak, too. They had a bizarre note about Universal. They said, oh, Universal, they did this big thing, and they did it without a superhero franchise.
Okay.
Like, oh, look how noteworthy it was that they set this record without having a superhero franchise.
I thought Vin Diesel was... I thought he was a superhero. You're saying Vin Diesel's not a superhero?
Yeah, they've got the Jurassic World franchise. They've got the Hot Car franchise of Fast and Furious. They have the Despicable Me franchise. However did they do it? It's like, okay, they didn't have that franchise, but they've got 18 others. It's not like they made all original films about, you know, yak herders in the mountains and set a record that way. They were making Fast and Furious 7.
Yak herders.
Yeah. Well, you know, come on. They made it sound like they were artisans or something, crafting unique little films, and they're just artists. Yeah, let's make another Minions. You know, come on. So I didn't get that comment, but anyway, I just wanted to have fun. Variety's not past its prime. It's an evergreen. But coming out this week is Straight Outta Compton. I'm gonna like the soundtrack and I'm gonna go see the film. And I will not sing along in the audience because I'm not an idiot. Also opening up is The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I have a weird interest in, and a new Noah Baumbach film, Mistress America.
Which got, you know, some decent reviews out of Sundance, if I recall correctly.
Oh, well, there you go. I haven't seen it yet. So no new movie this week, next month, or next quarter from DreamWorks Animation. How are they doing?
Well, I would say we should talk about them a lot, but there's not a lot to talk about since they're not making a lot of money.
Well, but they did make financial news, didn't they?
Yes,
they were supposed
but not good
to lose
financial
18 cents per share and they lost 45 cents. Whoops.
Oh, wait, what? Wait, so if you're supposed to lose 18 cents per share, which one is it where you go down and it actually goes up? I think it's golf, right?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And Wall Street, this is where I brought this all up. Wall Street expected DreamWorks Animation to make $167 million in quarterly revenue. This is the most recent revenue that they just reported. The revenue was actually, instead of $167 million, it was actually $170.8 million, beating expectations.
That sounds like, fantastic.
Well, that does, but like, you know. That's not beating. It's like they were on target, weren't they?
If
they
predicted
167 million and they made 170 million, they matched expectations. I mean, that's a rounding error, surely. And I feel like financial coverage of Hollywood and Hollywood studios are all these conglomerates are taking a beating because everybody's like, oh, they're losing subscribers. Everybody's cutting the cord. They're not going to make any money anymore. It's a stupid overreaction to, you know, serious big changes in the business, but a bizarre overreaction given the essential stability of all the big conglomerates. They're all making money and doing well. And I feel like all the coverage of stock and all this stuff, it feels like the political coverage. You know, they focus on the polls and the campaign strategy rather than the fundamentals. You know, like, where do they stand on the issues? Or in this case, you know, how is DreamWorks Animation, you know, set up? Well, we're not going to know anything for like 2 years, right? We got to wait for them.
Which is why, frankly, I don't think DreamWorks Animation has any shot at the presidency.
Probably not. Oh, well. But there's a lot of changes in the industry, aren't there?
Yeah. I mean, I think at least in the movie industry, I know what you're talking about with the television industry, that Disney and Cablevision, they all come out saying
cord cutting and video on demand and streaming and binge watching and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And it sent, you know, stocks spiraling last week down. Media stocks were down last week because of it, because all of these earnings came out. And of course, it's the company's fiduciary responsibility to say, oh, by the way, this whole digital thing is kind of, you know, there's some fear, uncertainty, and doubt there for you guys and for us, because there's all this cord cutting and revenues coming in from different areas now. We're not really sure where and when and how. And so anyway, we got to go. And, you know, so stocks went down. But there's also some changes in the way movies are being distributed. And we talked a little bit about this in the past with the way and in the recent past, Paramount announced that two horror films, one of which is a Paranormal Activity, the other is another zombie vampire type movie. Boy Scout zombies, yeah. That they're going to try and do this, what I like to call, and I think we can coin this term here, Michael, a fast follow release, which is they're going to release it theatrically, the normal way, but then as the movie exits theaters, at some point, it will be in fewer than 300 screens. And at that point, when it's on 298 screens, the clock starts ticking. And 17 days later, it can premiere on VOD and streaming and wherever else, you know, which the next window will start. And,
all right.
And so a lot of people are, oh my gosh, well, you know, if it's only in theaters for 3 weeks, then 17 days later, that would shrink the window, the theatrical window, down from 3 to 4 months down to like 6 weeks, and that's as crazy. And so some exhibitors like Regal say, well, that's not in our best long-term interest. We want that theatrical experience to be so exclusive that there's none of this 17-day clock thing. Then there are others like AMC and Cineplex in Canada who have said, okay, we're working with Paramount, and we're all happy. All the theater chains have said, look, we're happy that Paramount came to us and is approaching us, and we're talking about it, because that's a start.
But the news here was that more theater chains joined in with this experiment. They said, okay, you're giving us a piece of the revenue of video on demand.
That's
and in
key.
Return, we'll let you shorten the window.
Yes. So Paramount has said, look, during a time which they have not made public yet, we will give you a certain percentage, also that percentage not made public, of the digital revenue that's made, because you're helping us market it through a theatrical release. So during these windows, we will partner
on this.
Right.
All right. So to step back for just a second before you talk more. So we're looking at changes in the entertainment business, which is always happening, I guess. There's never been a period where there weren't big changes. But there's a lot of, because of digital, there's a lot of changes in movies like this, a lot of changes in TV. There's also a lot of changes in music because everybody's converting to streaming. And there's a lot of changes in publishing because ebooks and how books are in print and all that. So we've got changes in all these segments that we're going to cover here. This first one is film distribution, and Paramount is offering up a new model, or at least a potential model, for certain movies that don't have a long window. And if, again, these horror films end up being great and having long legs, everybody's happy. If it's in the theaters for 6 months because it's making $300 million, they're not going to be angry that they couldn't put it on VOD earlier, are they?
No, they're going to say, great, you know, it will be interesting to see if a distributor says, we're pulling the movie from you. Because right now, that rarely, if ever, happens. As one distributor told me a couple of years ago, if we can make $10 on a play date, meaning if we book a film in a theater for a week and all we will make is $10 on that play date for the entire week, we want the play date.
No, that's not true. I thought studios often would say, all right, there's only X number of screens and they've got a new movie coming in, and they know that the other movie that they have out there is basically past its prime. They say, all right, we know you booked it for 3 weeks, but it's already played out after 2 weeks. Feel free to give us our big screens for the new movie. they do the horse trading all the time, don't they? Especially if it's, you know, premium screens or IMAX screens or 3D screens.
First of all, that's against the law. Okay, so they can't do block booking like that, at least in the U.S. And second,
I thought all the time they you talk about IMAX, they're like, all right, yeah, we know our movie. We got
that's IMAX, that's programmed. But I'm talking about actual screen, you know, non-premium screens. They can't do block booking if you don't play this. You don't get that kind of thing.
No. That's not what I said. Described. I said the theater chains agreed to show a movie for 3 weeks, and the studio releases from their obligation because they know they've got a movie coming in. The old movie's played out, and nobody cares about it anymore. So they say, yeah, we understand. You don't want to keep playing. That's fine.
Yes. Now what you just said is, if Universal, I'm just using Universal as a hypothetical here. If Universal has a movie out for 2 weeks, it was supposed to be in theaters 3 weeks, and then they have a new movie coming out, Universal has a new movie coming out, then right. Yes, they will say, please take my Universal movie off.
Yes, that's what I described.
Yes. However, if it's a Universal movie that was supposed to play 3 weeks, and the exhibitor is saying, hey, look, we'd like to put the Warner Brothers movie in there, Universal is going to say,
I didn't talk about that. We didn't bring that up. Nobody brought that up.
Okay. Well,
you're defeating an argument that wasn't made.
Okay, well, ultimately, what I'm saying is it will be interesting to see whether booking patterns change because of this from either the exhibitor or the studio side.
Well, what do you think will happen? I would think if you're giving them a actual revenue stream from a new source, meaning video on demand, and they find it substantial and it's to their benefit to say it's played out in the theater, go knock yourself out, release it on VOD. Why not?
Yeah, I think if they can make more money on VOD, then the studio would want to pull it. And it would be interesting.
I'm saying if the theater chain, you know, I'm talking about the theater chain, wouldn't their attitude be, yeah, this is a substantial revenue stream. We're happy with it. We're happy with the percentage you gave us. We're happy with the books that we can see. And we're happy with the trade-off with the shortened window for a movie that has a shortened lifespan. And we all know that if it has legs and does well, we're all going to be happy to see it stay in the movie theater. Nobody's going to want to pull it if it's making money, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. But I would agree with that. If it's a Jurassic World, they're not going to pull it. What I would be interested in, and I think this is where Regal, which is the largest theater chain, if not in the world, certainly in North America, they have over 6,000 screens, where they said, look, it may not be in our long-term cultural interest. We want people forming a habit of coming to our movie theaters. We're not going to participate in this because we want people to think, I want to go see a movie. I have to go to the movie theater.
But that ship has sailed. Well, and it maybe hasn't sailed for Hollywood blockbusters, but it's sailed for everything else. And nobody thinks that way anymore. They were worried about cable in the 70s and VHS in the 80s and DVD in the 90s and streaming in the 2000s and video on demand. But like, I'm sorry, that model is gone.
Well, and you know who agrees with that is Ted Sarandos, the head of original content over at Netflix, who, of course, they have been picking up movies. They have the Adam Sandler movies they're working on, right? And
that's
now they
right.
have Beasts of No Nation. This is the, why am I blanking on his name?
Idris Elba?
Well, Idris Elba, yes, he's the star of it, but Fukunaga, the director.
Corey Fukunaga from True Detectives.
Corey Fukunaga, yes. I couldn't remember his first name. He True Detectives, he was the director of that. He's also a
Season one.
Season one, yes.
Let's give him credit and not diss him where it's due.
Oh, why?
He's not involved in season two.
Oh, you're saying it's season two's not doing well?
I haven't seen it. It's been pilloried.
Oh, well, I haven't seen it.
All of America hates it.
Well, he also has a great movie, Sin Nombre. If you ever get a chance to see it, it's a very good movie.
Right, they've backed his movie. It's got Oscar potential, and they're arguing, hey, we're going to show it in some theaters, but we want to show it on Netflix at the same time, and people need to relax about the idea that movies have to be playing in theaters instead of online or blah, 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 The Prestige and all that. They're like, who cares if we show it in 20 theaters? It's not a big deal. The important thing is millions of people will see it on Netflix.
Right, and they actually said, you know, with Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, we're going to do both an IMAX release and a day and date, same time, same place, same channel on Netflix. Okay. Same time. Now they're saying, look, when they picked up Beasts of No Nation for $12 million, everybody said, well, how are you going to do this? Because this is a movie that has some awards potential, and for it to have awards potential, it has to be in theaters and get reviewed by the big mainstream media outlets like the New York Times, the LA Times, you know, the big mainstream media outlets. And so nobody knew how that was going to play out or how Netflix was going to handle
that. Well, I thought they'd say, well, we'll show it in theaters. And then down the road, we'll show it on Netflix.
And that's exactly and what they're doing.
Stream. Everybody should be happy.
And I think they're doing it like what? I think they're doing it in about 20 art houses throughout the nation with landmark theaters. And they're doing a simultaneous.
That's the debut, right?
That's the debut and simultaneous release on Netflix when it appears in those theaters. So
right, and this is a new distribution model, not really, right? Because we've seen movies available on VOD before they hit IFC in the theater. We've seen movies available day and date. We're talking independent films, small films, art house films, and documentaries. This movie is, I guess they don't see it as a big blockbuster film. They're only opening it in 20 theaters, and they have no intention of platforming it and taking it wider, do they?
No.
That's the idea here. It's just we're giving it this glorified, you know, showcase in 20 theaters, but the main game here is showing it on Netflix.
Right, and this is where the LA Times said, and, you know, maybe it's best to quote Steve Zajcik, who wrote the piece. He says, if Netflix viewership is truly high, and as Michael, you point out always, we'll never know, a few art house theaters don't add much to the bottom line. Well, that's true. And it will likely just be a matter of time before they fall away as a key part of the release strategy, meaning eventually Netflix will be able to turn to filmmakers and say, look, do you really want us to release it in the... You're going to have 5,000 people see it in these theaters, or you could have 5 million people see it on Netflix. What do you want? And, you know, filmmakers will say, well, we want the 5 million people
to see it. Well, HBO works with major filmmakers, and they often release their movies overseas theatrically. And people don't say, well, why isn't it shown in movie theaters? They made a TV movie. They made a movie for TV, and it's shown on TV, and lots of people see it, and it's up for Emmys. But if you make a film, and you think this can win Oscars, and this can make money, make $20, $30, $40 million at the box office, why wouldn't you want to do that? Why would you want to say, no, we only want to show it on Netflix? If you make a movie and go, you know what? We made Toy Story 2 for direct-to-video, but it turned out really well. We want to release it theatrically. And guess what? Make $400-$600 million. You know, why if Netflix makes this movie and says, you know, it got accepted at Toronto. Toronto said, hey, this is a good, very good movie. We're going to show it as part of our film festival.
It's a valid work of art. It did get accepted at Toronto. I think it's also playing Venice. Yeah.
Exactly.
So,
if you made a movie that you think is Oscar worthy and can make money, I mean, I'm not talking about prestige and stroking the ego of a filmmaker. If you think Beasts of No Nation is worth releasing theatrically and could make money and would make you more money than if you didn't release it theatrically, why wouldn't you do that? And if you don't think so, of course, then it's a TV movie or a Netflix movie and you don't want to show it in a theater. But if it's worthy of being in a theater, if it's that type of movie and you think, you know what? I think it's going to create great reviews and make money, and we can platform it and get ready to open it wider if the box office is there. Why wouldn't they want to do that?
Well, because,
why are they saying no?
Well, because
box office is silly.
Because that's not their business.
Worried about the Oscar? Why is the LA Times talking about the Oscar? Why do they care? They're eligible for the Emmy. If Beast of No Nation can win the Emmy for Best TV Movie, great. Well, if they're playing the TV game or in the online game, why are we discussing box office and Oscar?
Because they're trying to play.
Why are they even showing it in a theater at all? Why are they bothering? HBO doesn't show
You ask a lot of questions. You don't wait for a lot of answers, do you?
HBO does not waste their time releasing movies in North American box office. Why is Netflix, if they don't care about it and they think it's a waste of time, and all they want to do is convince everybody, well, yeah, but give us Oscars, but we don't want to bother showing movie in theaters.
Well, because they wanted the movie. They want exclusive, big name talent and content that will attract people to Netflix, where people will say, oh yeah, I want to see that movie. I will subscribe to Netflix and I will subscribe for a year and I will pay my $12 or $10 per year, as opposed to $10 that one time to see the movie once, which is what Netflix wants. They want recurring revenue from subscribers.
They want to be HBO.
Yes.
They want to be HBO. Fine. So, but why are we angsting over whether or not they release a movie in a movie theater and whether it's eligible for an Oscar? Who cares? If they don't want to release it theatrically, fine. If they want to release it theatrically and make a lot of money and be eligible for Oscars, knock yourselves out. But to say, well, we want to show it on Netflix, but we don't want to waste our time showing it in movie theaters, but, you know, can't we be eligible for an Oscar? No.
Yeah.
Why are we even discussing it? You like the HBO model? Fine. Then you're HBO. You make stuff for TV and online.
Let's vehemently...
If you think you can make money, freaking release it theatrically and be prepared to expand it. I don't know why that's so anathema to them.
Beast of No Nation is
great and can run in movie theaters for 6 months. Won't that make it more valuable to them long term if they show it theatrically and wait before debuting it on Netflix?
Well, if you're Netflix, you might say, well, okay, if I have this movie exclusively and somebody wants to see it and they have to subscribe to Netflix, I'll have them for a year, maybe two. Okay, so I'm going to make $200-$300 from them. However, if I screen it theatrically and that same person goes to see it theatrically, I'll make $5 because they'll pay the $10 to the theater and I'll make the five. And they might not subscribe to Netflix. I'd rather take the exclusive Netflix option where I get recurring revenue for 2 years as opposed to the theatrical option. Now, that doesn't necessarily work when the talent and the content doesn't come your way because they prefer a theatrical release because it's viewed
as... Does HBO have trouble getting people making movies for them?
No, however, there's a whole other... We do not have time for that. There's a whole other reason for that, which has to do with the industry.
The reason is
large.
that they give them a lot of promotion and they get a lot of awards and they get a lot of attention, and it's a great platform for your work of art.
And the studios are making fewer films and the people have to work. And,
right,
yeah,
and the type of movies you're making. Right, exactly. So,
I think, quite honestly, the way the Weinstein Company is going about it for Macbeth, Michael Fassbender has done this Macbeth, they struck this deal with Amazon, which is not shocking at all, since actually the Weinstein Company and Netflix are releasing Crouching Tiger, but the Radius Weinstein Company, they're doing a fast follow release where it's an exclusive window for Amazon after the theatrical release. So there's a theatrical release,
then
2 to 3 months after the film is in theaters, Amazon gets it exclusively.
Well, is this a new window? Are we talking about the idea that this is 2 to 3 months after it debuts?
This is can I tell you what this is? This is called the premium pay TV window. And what I mean by that since we're talking about HBO, it's first the movie is in theaters, then it's on premium pay TV. What is premium pay TV? HBO, Showtime, Cinemax, all of those
That's
channels.
Not second, isn't DVD second? That comes out 12, you know, it's usually on DVD like 12 weeks after it's in theaters if you're talking about big movies.
Yeah, home video, yes. Okay,
isn't that second?
Yes, usually it is second. However, in this case, home entertainment and DVD and Blu-ray is kind of shrinking. So you have premium TV, and now in this case, premium streaming, which is taking the place of premium TV, or at least coexisting alongside it, is slowly gaining traction above home entertainment, home video.
Right. It's a new window, a new revenue stream. The only question is, have they shortened the window here? This vague 2 to 3 months after it hits theaters. Well, what do you mean?
Well,
it opens in theaters. When is it going to be on Amazon Prime? That's the question we have answered. We want, because that's what the theater companies are worried about. The distributors, the theatrical company. What the hell do you call them?
The exhibitors.
The movie theater exhibitors. Thank you. Yeah. What they want to know is, what do you mean it's opening up 2 months after it debuts in my theater? Wouldn't that make them angry? Why would they carry the film if it opens up 2 months after? If it opens up 8 weeks after the theatrical debut, that's shorter than the bloody horror film.
Well, here's the thing. This is a backtrack, in my opinion, for Radius, which would open films day and date most of the time. So they're basically saying, yeah, we're not going to do that day and date thing. We're going to wait at least 2 months. And you know what? They did the same thing with the Train movie. Which is
but most
no,
theaters
Snowpiercer.
Wouldn't carry a movie that opens up day and date, right? When you're talking day and date, you're talking things like tiny, tiny, like IFC Art House Theater.
Right.
Or and Alamo Draft House. It's not a wide release. So is this movie going to play on two screens and then be on Amazon Prime in 8 weeks? Who cares?
Well, and I think in this instance, what you have is the same thing that happened with Snowpiercer, which is the Train movie I was referencing, where, you know, the Radius TWC, the Weinstein Company, had to say, guys, we're going to release this movie theatrically, but just so that you know, we're also going to release it 2 weeks later on iTunes. Mm-hmm. And the theater said, oh, really? Well, guess what? You're not releasing it in our theater. And it kind of helped tank the movie. We talked about that in the past. We talked about that last summer, in fact.
Right.
And now they're basically saying it up front. They're letting the public know, hey, this is what we're doing with Macbeth. We're going to do it, and we're going to do it exclusively with Amazon.
Everyone's trying to figure out how to make money.
Yes, pretty much.
And there's always the studios, kind of foolishly sometimes, always want to shrink the window.
Yes.
Ever since they've had a chance, they're like, let's get it on cable quicker. Let's get it on VHS quicker. Let's get it on DVD quicker. sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't. But with indie films and small films and little art house films like Macbeth, which they're clearly not expecting to, you know, make $300 million, you know, the windows have collapsed.
That's true.
Right? And there's a million examples, right? Opening on demand before it hits a theater. Because it's only going to be on a few theaters and it's not going to have a long theatrical run. So all the rule books are out the window for tiny little movies. Basically, all that's left is big studio films. That's the only area where we've got the old-fashioned release it in the theater, then it comes out on DVD, then it's available on demand and premium cable and all that sort of stuff. And there are new players like Amazon and Netflix and all that, sure.
And someday movie theaters will be, you know, they'll cost $100. And
yeah,
and right. Oh, wait, so, a second. Who said that? Was it Steven Spielberg and George Lucas at USC a couple of years ago? Yeah, I believe it was.
Yeah, so I mean, nothing's changed here for small art house films. Those windows have collapsed. That story, that's happened. That's done.
Okay.
Right? The only question is there something new in this wrinkle? I don't think so, from the reporting here. We don't know when it's going to open. We don't know how many theaters it's opening. We don't know how long after it opens.
There's only one new thing, and that is that there's still some uncertainty.
That Amazon has money.
Yeah, and that there's still some uncertainty. You know what there's no uncertainty about? That record labels make more money than the musicians that they release.
Well, and that they're not going to open up their books.
That also, by the way, what you just said, there's no uncertainty about that. They will definitely not be opening their books, so that David Byrne, formerly of the Talking Heads, also a great solo musician who I've seen live many times. He's a great musician and a great artist. And you know, he may want to take a look at the record label's finances, and he may be calling for that, and he may request more transparency in record label finances, but I highly doubt he will ever get it.
That's right. He had an op-ed in the New York Times, and it was building on a number of other artists who have spoken out recently. The Times had another article sort of pegged to this that sort of round up all the people like Allo Black, who's been documenting the money he makes off his song that he co-wrote called Wake Me Up, a terrific tune by Avicii. And he has documented that he has made $4,000 total from Pandora for the song Wake Me Up. It's streamed 168 million times, and his check is $4,000. So he's saying, look, he's opening up his books to say, this is the money I'm actually making off what is probably and possibly a once-in-a-lifetime monster hit. You know, Wake Me Up is a huge worldwide smash. You're rarely going to have that many streams, and if you're really lucky and hit a home run, you're going to make $4,000 as a co-songwriter on the tune. So he's opening up his books. Taylor Swift wanted Amazon to back off of their deal to say, well, we're going to give you this new streaming service for 3 months, and we're not going to make you pay for it, and we're not going to give any royalties.
Actually, it was Apple that she wrote.
I mean, Apple. I think, did I say Amazon?
Yes. It's kind of hard to, yeah.
Right. So she spoke up, and now David Byrne has written an article saying, you know what? Record labels need to be transparent. There's a lot of money out there, but we don't know where it's going. And until there's transparency, no one's going to be happy. But there's money to be made, but we all have to work together. And honesty is very, very important.
Well,
I think there
was
a little laughter when he said that.
Yeah, I think what's going to wind up happening, though, is
nothing.
Nothing right now. But the deal that Spotify has with these record labels, where the record labels have an equity stake in Spotify, that's actually going to come back to bite the record labels. Because,
well, it should. Yeah, they should. Yeah, because sued, and they should. You know, you can't say you can make a gazillion dollars off an investment in a company and tell artists, oh, that and the advance payments don't count either. You know, it's digital. So David Byrne says, look, where's all this money going? First of all, they have stakes in these streaming companies like Spotify. Secondly, they get advance payments for stuff like manufacturing and shipping, which is minimal to non-existent when you're talking about digital music. How are royalties meted out? We don't know. It's a mystery. How much is overhead? We don't know. It's a mystery. How much do certain songs and albums and artists generate in revenue, and how much do they actually get? Because the record labels have no obligation to say, okay, your song brought in this amount of money, and therefore this is your cut. They can apportion it pretty much any way they want. And he says, we've got to open source all the financials. And the record labels said, I'm sorry, we'll talk to you later.
Yeah, they said, oh, yeah, we'll be with you in a moment. Can you hold for just a moment?
He had some great stuff. He said he went to YouTube and had some questions. He said, hey, you know, what's the ad revenue split? Like, you know,
but everybody knows that. It's 60-40 or 50-50. Everybody knows, you know, there are other places to find out that information.
Well, YouTube said, well, we get less than half. An industry guy says, no, it's about 50% to YouTube, 35% to the owner of the master recording, and 15% to the publisher. And YouTube said, we really can't talk about that. unless you're an actual publisher or an owner. He's like, well, I am an owner. I have my own record label. I own it. I'm like, yeah, no, we still won't tell you. And he did the same thing with streaming services. He went up and said, I own my record label. You're using, you want contracts with my stuff. I'd like to know. They're like, no, we can't tell you. So basically he went everywhere as you know, fully invested in everything. He owns a record label. He's an artist. He's, you know, he's a songwriter, and yet he can't get information from YouTube or the publisher or the record label or the streaming companies or anyone about where the money's going and who gets it.
Well, remember that documentary? I don't know if you saw it, Michael. Searching for Sugarman?
Yes.
Which Rodriguez, remember?
Yeah, Silvio Rodriguez.
Yeah. There was a point in that documentary where the filmmaker was asking the person who had owned those recordings and the record company that made them in the 1960s. He made, you know, he sold like 500,000 records or more in South Africa, and the checks were being sent back to the U.S. to the record company. And so the documentary filmmaker was asking the head of that record company, a very small record company, where are those checks? Where did all that money go? And the guy just basically stonewalled him and just said, I didn't get any checks. There were no checks. I didn't see any checks. Did you see any checks? I didn't see it. And so effectively, that's the way the music industry has always handled it. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't tell you that.
That may not be a great example, since I believe there was also a lot of bootlegging in South Africa, and it was a bit of a closed market for various political reasons.
Yes.
So it's not a great example, but it's true overall. But again, there's not going to be any transparency. Nothing's going to change unless there are class action lawsuits by artists, or the government steps in and attorney generals around the states and around the country and start to step in and sue and look into what's going on, because it's a scam.
Toward the end of a book called How Music Got Free, which is a book you and I, Michael, have talked about, privately. This is a new book. You should read it. And toward the end, you'll find out how record companies, they pay the advances and where all that money goes, and basically how it does not go to the artists eventually. They go into detail about why it doesn't go to the artist. Not that it's right, just how it doesn't get to the artist.
Right. And we're seeing the same roiling changes in the book industry. Things have gone digital, and the authors go to saying, look, it's a new world out there, and we need new contracts for a digital era. And of course, every author negotiates their own contract, but there tend to be boilerplate contracts that all new authors have to kind of basically sign. They don't have a lot of leverage unless they're one of the lucky few. And the authors go to saying, look, there are some basic things in all our contracts that need to change and reflect the world we're in. And their white paper on this is called A Publishing Contract Should Not Be Forever.
Right. Well, neither should copyright. Just ask Mickey Mouse. Then, you know,
absolutely. And the author's skill would agree with that, I think, to a degree, because it's the publishing and the conglomerates that are controlling it more than the authors themselves.
Yeah. Right now, a publisher has the rights to most books that they publish for the lifetime of the author plus 70 years, which is minus the one, carry the two. Yeah. Forever, actually.
Right. Exactly. And the guild has said, look, there need to be a couple changes. One, contracts should not be for, 150 years. They should be for a limited time, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. And whatever that limited contract ends, you can renegotiate and do an extension if both parties want to. Number two, subsidiary rights got to go back to the author, even if they're not exploited in 18 to 24 months.
Now, basically, what I would say, the sub rights, as they're known, are like if somebody wants to make a movie.
Like make a movie or a TV show or an online thing. And they say, why should the author suffer just because the publisher can't or won't exploit any potential rights? You know, if you haven't sold it to the movies in 2 years, you're not going to probably. And or if you do eventually, it should come back to us. You know, if you haven't done it in 18 months to 2 years, it's not happening. And we should have those rights. And number three, this is the one I've been wondering about for a while. In most contracts, there was an out-of-print clause. And the author's guild says that should be eliminated. In the past, if a publisher did not keep your book in print, and believe me, even well-known, well-reviewed, best-selling authors, their books go out of print all the time. And so eventually, when that happens, the rights will revert back to the author. And that happens for everybody. I mean, I interview authors who are, critically acclaimed and are going to be read for decades to come, if not centuries, and their books go out of print. It's kind of embarrassing.
This was the whole kerfuffle with Google when they were doing all the scanning of the books of these quote-unquote orphaned books. Like, well, who owns the rights to them? Well, the authors do. But where are the authors? We can't find them. So they were these orphaned books, and this is what you're talking about.
Well, not quite. This is a question of who controls the book. And in the case, if the book stays in print, it's the publisher. But how do you determine that anymore? In the old days, it was easy. If they weren't printing copies of the book and they weren't getting sales, nothing happened and the book would go out of print. And they wouldn't bother making any more copies. It wouldn't be available in stores. Nobody could get it. They couldn't even order a copy. And that meant it was out of print. And that meant the rights reverted to the author. That's what happened. But now today with digital, books stay in print forever. It's always available for purchase, if it, at least in one format. And so therefore, the rights will never revert to the author. Even if the publisher is doing nothing with the book, it's just sitting there. They're not promoting it. They're not marketing it. They're not pushing people to buy it. They're not doing anything with it. But because it costs them nothing to make it digitally available, they can leave it in print, I'm putting that in quotes, basically forever. So the rights would never revert to the author. And so the author's code says, hey, that's got to change. And instead of saying in print, out of print, what format, let's just use a revenue marker and say if the book doesn't generate, say, $500 in sales in a year, then it's out of print and the rights revert to the author. And that avoids the problem of like saying, oh, it's in print. We made sale this year because we put it on sale for a penny online digitally. You know, so they can't keep a book in print by trying to get around, you know, do a runaround of the technical rules. They say, look, if it doesn't generate a certain amount of money, it's out of print. The author gets the book back.
Yeah,
if
and I would say
sold the rights after 18 months to 2 years, that's it. It's over. The rights go back to the author. The author deserves more control, more rights, and more power, to which the publishers will say, why?
Right. Well, and the publishers would say, yes, but we're taking the risk. And to that,
that's fine. But once the book has died and it's over with, they're now exploiting a bizarre in-print, out-of-print clause to pretend that they're still working the book when normally it would have reverted to the author by now. So this is just a new wrinkle. Because it's available digitally, they can pretend it's still in print when essentially it is out of print, but the new rules need to reflect that. So we're not taking anything away from the publishers there by fixing the out-of-print clause. We're just reflecting reality. Today, they can keep a book in print forever because there's a digital copy. And that's not really fair or true. And books would go out of print all the time and revert to the author. But today they don't. And now we need to fix that. That seems to me the easiest fix.
And if any of that was changed, I'd say it would be a big deal.
That's right.
Which means, of course, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. I tried to say that fast. How did I do?
Great.
Okay, well, our first story. People watch the Super Bowl on network TV, Michael. You probably know that.
Yes.
People also now can watch the Super Bowl via live streaming. The ads that appeared on TV sometimes appeared on the live stream, sometimes not. No more. CBS is bundling it all together and insisting that every advertiser of the big game also be on board for the live stream. It's an acknowledgement that viewing happens everywhere and the ad should run everywhere and that the eyeballs you reach online count just as much as the eyeballs on TV. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop because it's, you know, it's the new world we live in. I never quite understood why online, for something like a live event, why they would be different. If you buy the ad, you should appear there. It seems an obvious add-on, you know, thing.
Well, that has a lot to do with the technical infrastructure behind the way ads are served, but that's...
It would seem easier to maintain the same ads to me.
It's harder.
You sell three ads for that three-minute segment where between, you know, the commercial break, make them the same online. It seems a lot simpler.
Well, from a technical standpoint, what I mean by technical is I mean the actual engineering of who delivers the ads technically, engineering-wise, and where those ads are served from, and that's why you can see local ads roll in for certain portions. So that's fully an infrastructure issue.
Okay.
Now, my question for all of this is, are jobs passé?
That's what the robots say.
Well, companies certainly don't seem to want to have employees anymore. I mean, look at Rolling Stone. Their name brand film critic, Peter Travers, was shown the door recently, and not just because it was a brand new door and they had just installed it. They dumped him from his staff job, told him he could take or leave a freelance gig contract, i.e. no full-time job, no benefits, and what comes with that? Oh, yeah, that's right, reduced pay. But no matter what, he had to be out of his office. Well, let's see, yesterday, right away. Oh, and that freelance gig money, by the way, that would be deducted from his severance package, so he could keep his byline, but he wouldn't really get any more money from them ever again. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? I mean, it's just the latest. You know, nobody wants staff writers anymore. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know. And the way they fired him and dumped him was so insulting. Oh, my God. You're like, all right, you'll get 200,000 severance. If you want to keep writing for us, fine, but we're going to take it out of that 200,000. Meaning that's all you're getting. You want to keep your byline, fine, kid. We can pretend you're still, you know, writing for us, but you're going to do it for free, right? You just get the glory of doing it for Rolling Stone. That's basically what they're saying, because you're not getting a penny extra. So he's supposed to write for them for free, or you can just get out.
Now, what would you do?
Well, I mean, what do you mean?
Would you take the money and then keep writing, or would you?
No, I wouldn't write for free for Rolling Stone when I've already been paid by them and on staff and on contract with benefits. Of course not.
Same here. Yeah. Ryan Adams is officially a Taylor Swift fan. Ryan Adams, the singer-songwriter. He tweeted out that he's recording a track-by-track cover of her entire new album, which is titled 1989. Why? She wondered. And he returned, because they're badass tunes. We're sandblasting them, and they're holding steady. That's what he said. This was all done on Twitter, because that's where, you know, musicians and rock stars have their conversations these days. It is surely the fastest tribute to an album in music history. But is it a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
Oh, man. Okay.
People got digital studios. They can do this sort of stuff. Hence, they will.
And I have to say, the way he is going about it, I mean, he actually posts little, like, 30-second clips of them recording. Every night, they go in and he says, oh, this is what we're recording tonight. I mean, he's, like, not kidding around. He's really doing this.
I didn't think it was a joke.
Okay. Video games to the rescue, then. That's how the big multinational entertainment companies must feel. Time Warner beat expectations for its most recent quarter thanks in part to video games and video game hits like Batman: Arkham Knight, as well as new revenue streams for licensing old TV shows like that Seinfeld deal. Sony is looking to the future. Their upcoming launch of the video game Halo 5. What is that, Sony? Is that Microsoft? I think that's Microsoft.
Oh, beg your pardon.
Yeah. Well, make that the only... That's the element of success for powering console sales. That really is that those exclusive games. That's the only element there. And to make a hit, they're paying major attention to gamers and the increasingly important tournaments that give video games huge visibility. Finally, China is lifting a 15-year ban on console games, but new consoles must be built in one of their quote-unquote free zones. Upon word of the ban being lifted, executives at Sony and Nintendo broke down in tears. And we're not ashamed. Big deal or big whoop.
Whew. That's a lot of video game news. So Halo 5 is a key new video game, and it reflects the importance of these tournaments, which really have not, I don't think, broken into the mainstream yet. People are not aware of how much young people are going to like an arena and watching people compete in video games. I don't think it's really crossed over and people realize how big a deal that is so far.
No, if people understood how much some of these professional video game players make in a year or per tournament, they might stop yelling at their teenage kids to put down the video game and go outside. They would actually be saying, I'm sorry, have you practiced today? Have you like practiced Halo 5?
Right. And China, by the way, opening up to consoles, even if they have to be built in China, is a big deal because they're the second biggest video game market in the world.
Yes.
$22 billion a year, second only to Japan, which, of course, is a much smaller country. But how can they be a big market if they don't allow console sales? Digital games, online games, smartphone games. That's how they do that. So, and, you know, talking about how out of touch I am with video games, I couldn't even understand a correction that ran in the New York Times. About their Halo 5 story, they wrote, an earlier version of this article rendered incorrectly the term for the game category that includes League of Legends. It is Multiplayer Online Battle Arena, or MOBA, not Multiplayer Online Arena Battle Game.
Oh,
I'm like, well, thanks for clearing that up.
You know, I'll
Multiplayer Online Battle Arena instead of Multiplayer Online Arena Battle Game. I have no idea.
You know, I'll never forget, as a teenager, I was over at my girlfriend's house at the time, and the Grammys were on. And there was Boyz II Men up singing something and dancing around. And, you know, my girlfriend's father said, who are these guys making this stupid music? And I thought, oh, you're so out of touch. And now I hear you say all of those words, and I know they're in English. I know they're in a language I understand, and yet I don't understand any of it.
Basically, these are games that are designed for people to be able to compete against each other. And this is what Halo 4 failed to do. They had a sort of random weapons where certain people would get bigger, better weapons, or they could fly above you and shoot down at you, and other people didn't get that, which is horrible if you're trying to compete and all be on a level playing field. And so they realized Halo 5 and a lot of these people, when they're designing games that they want to be used in tournaments, that the hardcore pros, they've got to have that level playing field. Maybe a casual person like me would like to have suddenly I can fly and shoot Sperling in the head, you know, from being above him. But that's not cool if you're going to try to have a tournament. And so they're talking about in these games, you got to have a level playing field. And the multiplayer online games are where you've got multiple people competing against each other, like to steal the flag from their tower. That's the sort of old person way to think about it. And they basically have the same weapons and the same things, and they work together or singly to compete against each other. And they're all sort of on the same level field, and that's a battle arena. But there's a difference between a battle arena and an arena battle game, which I am incapable, apparently, of figuring out.
Well, then maybe I'm mistaken. I heard some English words in there, but not all, actually. Now, in another sign of the end of times,
to be or not to be.
As a matter of fact, that's the way we should have started this show, because that is the way that the new Hamlet, which is starring Benedict Cumberbatch. In fact, two London newspapers got so excited about Benedict Cumberbatch tackling Hamlet that they sent critics to review the show, which begins with the to be or not to be speech, by the way.
Not quite.
Well, okay, yes. But they sent...
It's like in the middle or towards the end. But anyway,
no,
it doesn't begin with to be or not to be.
In this production.
In this production, it does?
Yes. That was the big deal.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh. Okay, I beg your pardon.
But
really? They put it at the beginning?
Yes, it's a...
That's bizarre.
Big
okay.
Controversy. These two newspapers, however, they sent their critics or their people, their the people who are going to review, not critics, but they sent them on the night of its very first preview. The last time critics jumped the gun and reviewed a show before it had officially opened was when reviewers finally weighed in on Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. See, I haven't forgotten, Michael. In that case, the show seemed like it would never end its preview performances. In this case, well, actually, there is no case to be made for this. The two offending papers, the trashy Daily Mail, which sent a columnist, not a critic, who gave the show 5 stars, and the Times of London, which sent a freelancer who gave the production 2 stars. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but it's a big deal because it's so embarrassing that the Times of London did this.
I know.
I mean, the Daily Mail, whatever, you know, good God, it's terrible. They shouldn't do it. It's to review a show on its first preview is ridiculous. But for the Times, that just shows you the pressure that they have. The Daily Mail has one of the biggest websites in the world. Everybody goes to the Daily Mail website, and you can see how their trashy way of getting clicks has affected Huffington Post and so many newspaper media outlets around the world. And to see the Times of London stoop to that level, it's insulting. I would be furious with them. You know, I wouldn't let them do anything for a week. You know, it's just awful, 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 awful. The dumbing down of the world.
Hey, remember that Blurred Lines court case that we spoke about a couple episodes ago?
I do.
Well, it's having an effect on songwriters. Music superstar Miguel came up with a song on his new album called Leaves. He decided it was, quote unquote, reminiscent of the Smashing Pumpkins song 1979, reaching out to Billy Corgan, and he gave him co-songwriting credit. And he says, it's all about respect, says Miguel. It's also all about not being sued, but that's another story. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I don't know. I mean, is it something that he felt I wouldn't have? He didn't deserve songwriting, but I felt he needed to have it because I'd be sued? Or is it like, no, I was actually lifting melodies and stuff from this song that deserves co-songwriting credit. So
I will say
I don't
this.
Get it.
We can't be sure unless they come out and say, no, I actually lifted the song or I actually, you know.
Well, you can because you go to court, you sue, and they make a legal determination.
Well, no. I mean, in this instance. But I do
right.
think now when like 5 people come up to you if you're a songwriter, 5 people come up to you and say, you know, it sounds just like, and they say the name of the same name of the same song. I think then you're kind of like, oh, crud, we may as well just give him credit now. Whereas, yeah. As opposed to actually kind of cribbing some of the song.
But there's only so many notes. There's lots of songs that
are in the same vibe.
You know, you're talking disco tunes don't have a lot of common ground.
No, they all have.
Oh, my God, female voice and a big thumping bass and, you know, come on.
Morality in media. a long-established advocacy group, has convinced two major retailers, Food Lion and Rite Aid. I don't know if you would call them, well, yeah, Rite Aid's a retailer. Well, they've convinced them to start putting...
It's a drugstore, yeah.
Yeah, they've convinced them to put the women's magazine Cosmopolitan in racks that shield much of its cover from view, the way, say, pornography like Playboy is hidden from sight. Cosmo doesn't typically include scantily clad or naked women on its covers, but Morality and Media, now rebranded as the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, that's a mouthful, is worried minors might read headlines like, "Sex so hot, you'll need to crank the AC," and "Oh my goddess!" exclamation mark, "the sex move he will worship you for." Cosmo responded, "Thank you for making us seem cool and cutting edge again. Big deal or big whoop?"
Well, it's a big whoop, of course, but it's a shame that these retailers caved, and it's questionable. I mean, this is not pornography. This is not curse words. This is not nudity. It's literally text about saying, "Oh, here's a way to have really good sex."
Yeah,
it
you know
be
what?
In the context of a marriage, the idea that that is porn and that children should not be able to read the words, you know, "the sex move he will worship you for," and that they'll be somehow, you know, that is now the new standard of morality. That's where you draw like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't even want to see words referencing sex, even if it's for a healthy, committed relationship in a marriage with two kids and a dog." I mean, that is the idea that they would convince Food Lion and Rite Aid that that is somehow porn and his children must be protected from even seeing the idea that people have sex, much less no nudity, no cursing, no explicitness, nothing. I mean, that's frightening. Plus, of course, it's such a double standard. You know, it's a women's magazine. You don't see men's magazines like Maxim or Sports Illustrated. You don't see them behind blinders.
Actually, you do. You do.
No, you don't.
Actually, go to an airport. You do.
Well, maybe in an airport you do. I don't. I went down and looked at I went down to Walmart to check before I said that.
Okay. Well, I can tell you at the airport, I'm like, why are those magazines behind? You know, because, you know, Maxim, mostly Maxim. I will say it's mostly Maxim. But here's what I would do.
I would say that my caveat to that would be, well, Morality Media would say, well, we want them behind the blinders too.
Yes.
So they're not being hypocritical. But it does, the fact that they were able to succeed against a women's magazine is kind of telling, especially since it's just text.
Apparently, Zayn Malik, speaking of caving pretty darn quickly, Zayn Malik of One Direction, he's grown bored of normal life, and he grew bored of it pretty darn quickly. Widely considered the best singer in the group of One Direction, but not the best looking, Malik left the boy band in March in the middle of a world tour. He cited stress, and Malik insisted he wanted to live like a normal 22-year-old and be out of the spotlight. 4 months later, however, Malik announced he'd be launching his solo career with his debut album due out in 2016. Big deal or big whoop?
I love making you describe who's a better looking member of One Direction.
and yet they could walk in here right now to the studio. I wouldn't know one single, but maybe that Harry Styles guy only
you know
because
Harry
of his
Styles.
Hair. Yeah.
Well, anyway, this is that bitch. I mean, Zayn Malik, what a stupid way to launch your solo career. He should fire his management because he walked out in the middle of a world tour, which is ridiculous and irresponsible. And then he's insisted to the world, "Oh, I just want to be alone and quiet and rest." You know, okay, fine. And then 4 months later, he's announcing a solo album. That's the worst handling of a launch of a solo career I've seen in a while. Bad blood for One Direction fans, bad blood with him and the other guys, and bad blood with everybody who took him at his word when he pretended that he really just wanted to, you know, rest and, you know, he was stressed out by being the center of the storm. You know, they failed every possible way. Finished the tour. Give everybody a hug and go solo and let everybody know above board what you're doing. Or don't finish the tour. Don't lie about why. I mean, it's just stupid, stupid, stupid. It won't matter. A year from now, he'll release the album. If it's good, it'll do well. But a very dumb PR move, and all the people around him who are responsible who let him do that, walk on a tour. I mean, it's just bad.
Top Gear fans rejoice. Jeremy Clarkson was dumped by the BBC and they own the rights to the car-centric TV show. But Clarkson and his co-hosts have just signed a worldwide deal with Amazon to do another Car Crazy TV show. In fact, they should probably just call it Car Crazy. ITV was the front runner to snag the guys, but the BBC had a clause in their contract saying they couldn't do a car show for 3 years in the United Kingdom. So, Amazon it is, with their longtime producer along for the ride. Was it the longtime producer that got punched, which caused this whole thing? Anyway,
probably not.
Probably not. Okay. It's due out in 2016, sometime on Amazon Prime. Will Clarkson create headaches with Amazon due to offensive and controversial comments? Have you ever tried to get someone on the phone at Amazon for any reason? Does it matter? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course, but I mean, this is a huge franchise. It's one of the biggest TV shows in the world. Amazon is a worldwide player. It makes sense for them or Netflix. And the real impact is relook at your contracts again, because if all you say is you can't do it in this market, you got to define how this market is. I mean, that's, you know, true. What's the big advantage of saying they can't do it in the UK if they can do it for Amazon and do it around the whole world?
Yeah, well, that's
isn't Amazon available in the UK? I mean, how you define whether a show is made in and for the UK versus everywhere else in this day and age, that's an outdated contract. And there is a TV show called Car Crazy. It's been around for 19 years, and I think the current host is Barry Meguiar.
Well, you know what? Even Miss Piggy and Kermit know about that whole thing. And here, I know you don't want to talk about this, but even they, in their little tweet about breaking up, they said that that they will continue to work together on television and, quote, and in all media now known or hereafter devised in perpetuity throughout the universe. Yes.
Did they say that?
Yes.
Oh, that's funny.
So that was kind of like an inside joke about, like, when you're signing a contract like that, you're signing, you know, for all media everywhere, even in the universe.
Well, that was a good PR stunt, and it paid off better than I would have expected for their new TV show. I have seen a couple of the pilots for the fall season, and the 10-minute reel that they used to sell the show to the network was, in fact, very funny, I have to say. And I'm looking forward to checking out The Muppets when it airs on ABC.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, or these past 2 weeks. Now it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. Well, I guess this week how they affect you is you won't be seeing any Relativity Media movies anytime soon, or at least not as soon as you'd hoped.
That's right. I mean, Relativity filed for bankruptcy. So I looked at that and I thought, oh, big whoop. New guy comes to Hollywood. I'm going to change how they do business. I've got the real formula figuring out hits. And he comes to Hollywood with a pile of cash and gets taken to the cleaners eventually. But I feel like it's just like with the Arabs. Just like with the Japanese, just like with the Chinese, new people come to town with a lot of money. Hollywood says, step right on up. Help us fund our movies. Thank you very much. So why is this not that story? What's different about this than my, you know, outsider perspective?
Well, first of all, Ryan Kavanaugh, who is the outsider you're referring to, he came and said he was going to change everything. So that probably didn't help his cause here. But it's also because so much money was involved. This is the biggest corporate bankruptcy in Hollywood history, although I guess...
How is that possible? United Artists and others? There's never been a bigger one?
Well, not a billion-dollar bankruptcy, no. Okay. This is a billion-dollar bankruptcy.
I guess it's inflated money.
Yeah, but there you go. There you have it. You're absolutely right. Next week, it'll be some other company with a bigger bankruptcy. So Ryan Kavanaugh comes to town. He is a former venture capitalist who started a company when he was in his 20s that failed. So he's figured out a way to do Slate financing. He's going to do it based on a Monte Carlo modeling scheme. And with
which
that,
is what all Slate financing is, isn't it?
Well,
you know, spread out your bets. You know, Disney gave you back in the whatever that was called in the 80s or the early 90s, invest in Walt Disney and they'll have 10 or 12 movies on their slate and you'll invest in them. And some of them are sure to be hits and we'll all make money.
Right. Well, he came and he said, look, right now, studios, here's what you're doing. You have, you know, 30-40% of your movie, maybe 50% of your movie and 100% of your movie in the U.S. because you keep that. But then you start selling off Germany and Japan and South Korea. Why not own 100% of the entire world, okay, where you're making more money these days, and take 50% of the profits, okay, instead of only, you know, no profits from some of those territories. We'll come in, we'll give you 50% of the budget, but no cherry picking. We get 50% of every single movie. So if it's Spider-Man, we win. If it's some movie that doesn't make any money, we lose with you. And the studios, Sony and Universal specifically, and with Warner Brothers, it was Legendary. They all said, this is a great idea. We'll get to keep the rights for the entire world. We'll lower our risk by 50% and we'll split the revenue with the net profits. Net profits, as you know, Michael, it's hard to play tennis at a studio because they can never find the nets. We'll split the net profits with these financiers. Well, it's kind of a bad deal because, of course, the studio is also the distributor, and the distributor takes 15% of the gross box office. So they're taking 15% off the top right away.
Right. So, yeah, they made money, but he decided to wise up and said it's better to be the studio. We're telling the Ryan Kavanaugh story here. You're going through his entire life. Yeah, he started off in venture capital, made money, went bankrupt, came to Hollywood, did some slate financing, made some money, decided it was better and smarter to be your own studio, be in charge of making the movies, be in charge of that, because then you don't have somebody else taking money off the top, you know, so I'd rather be in business with myself. So right. He launched this company, Relativity Media. What went wrong?
Well, he forgot one thing. Universal, Sony, they're all owned by big corporate backers who can continue to finance a studio when you're waiting the 5 to 7 to 10 years for a specific movie to make back all of its revenue. So while he took smaller bets and he wasn't overspending on making $150 million movies.
And he had hits like The Social Network and The Fighter.
Yes, but the returns were smaller and it took longer to get them back than he had anticipated. And thus he kept borrowing more and more and more money. And he was paying, you know, basically taking money from Peter to pay Paul, and in the end, it all caught up with him, and he couldn't meet the debt fine. He couldn't meet the $350 debt payment, and had to file.
But the writing was on the writing was on the wall in 2012 when he sold off his library, right? Because if you're not keeping your library, you're out of the movie business.
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, I mean, so this is 3 years later, right?
Yeah.
So he's everybody been dancing in as Hollywood. Fast as he can for the last 3 years. Why is anybody? Nobody's surprised. And nobody's surprised that if you step back and go, you come into Hollywood and you don't have a big major corporation backing you and you want to be a studio and make movies, it's going to take you 10 or 20 years to build up a library and get the money out of the first movie you made, right?
Yeah.
So it's a long-term game. You got to have enough money to be around for 10 to 15 years before you can even think about being on long-term financial stability. And really, to build up a library, which is where you're really going to make your money down the road, you're looking at, you know, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, and I think Ryan Kavanaugh had a bit of a personality. He would go around to conferences, and I'd seen him speak a couple times, where, you know, he basically was like, I've got a formula, and I'm not telling anybody about it, but it's basically, you know, an algorithm that says, you know, if you have Tom Cruise starring in your movie, and you release it on a Friday,
An action film with one Japanese actor.
Right, exactly. And it's released on the third Friday of May, and that Friday is an odd number, and, you know, basically some big algorithm in this Monte Carlo scheme that he could guarantee certain profits. Well, what he forgot is that's not the way the court of
creative
public,
that's yes. Not the way creative industries work.
Correct. And you know, you could do that on smaller scales, and you could kind of use that a little bit to make an informed creative decision, but you can't rely on it 100%. And that's, I don't want to say that's what he was doing, but you know, it didn't work out. Now the problem with this bankruptcy is, of course, there are so many people now, so many lenders and so many financiers that have their hands in the pocket. There's the priority lenders and the sub lenders, but there's also this ripple effect that you're going to have with all.
Anytime a big player goes belly up, right?
Yeah, you have Technicolor, for instance, that's saying, "Hey, you know, we distributed that movie for you, and you never paid us for it." You have ad agencies saying, "Hey, we made those ads for you and you never paid. We bought those ads on CBS, NBC, ABC. You never paid us for it." Publicity firms not being paid, trailer houses not being paid. This is a ripple effect that goes beyond just Relativity, which laid off 75 of its 350 workers. The senior management is taking a 20% pay cut at least. And, you know, he hopes to kind of, he's in Chapter 11, not Chapter 7. So they hope to restructure. I don't see how Ryan Kavanaugh ends up as the CEO of this company at the other side.
Well, I mean, this is just, you know, hubris, thinking you've solved the problem of how to create profitable movies every time out and growing too big too fast. I remember the people who made Sling Blade, you know, the guys behind there, oh, why did we sell it to Miramax? You know, we could have made that $100 million off the movie. Well, no, you wouldn't have, because it wouldn't have grossed $100 million if Miramax hadn't been involved. And they thought they launched their own studio. And my friend did something for them, and he went to their office. Yeah, they had great offices, marble. They had a TV division, a music division. They're brand new. They made like one movie, and they were like having fancy offices with tons of money being spent on the, you know, on the facade of the place. And they were launching all these divisions. Look at Relativity. They have Relativity Studios and music and digital and Relativity Sports and Relativity Television and Relativity International. You know, they're just doing all this stuff when they hadn't even finished their knitting. You know, you got to do what you do well first. They had $20 billion invested in them. $20 billion.
Wait, who?
Citibank, Merrill Lynch, Deutsche Bank, and others.
Who had $20 billion?
The company's partners and financial institutions have invested $20 billion as of 2012 in entertainment partners with such as the ones I named. They also work in fashion, sports, digital, music. That's according to Variety.
Yeah, and they basically lent their, you know, they licensed their name out. So,
That's not smart either, is it?
Yeah, they even had a high school and a college and, you know.
A college?
Yeah, exactly. And now all of the students, mind you, the only part that went bankrupt is the studio. So all of those other things, the sports agents.
Those other things are not making money.
Well, they're the only ones that filed for bankruptcy. Everybody else did not. So, again, this is not all of their subsidiaries or their licensees and whatnot. However, there are people, you know what? Natalie Portman is affected by this. She directed this movie, Jane Got a Gun. It's a
they
Western.
They released it, though, didn't they?
No. As a matter of fact, because one of the producers is the offspring of David Boies. Do you know who David Boies is, Michael? The highfalutin lawyer there? I shouldn't say highfalutin. Big time lawyer is really what I meant to say. He defended Al Gore, in fact, or represented Al Gore in the Bush v. Gore Supreme Court case.
Lost.
Yeah, he lost. One other cases. Big name lawyer. One of his children is the producer. He basically was able to get the movie back. It was supposed to be released September 4th. It's a troubled production from the very beginning. But there are other films that won't actually be released now because of this, and certainly won't be released with the type of marketing campaigns that they should have, including a Zach Galifianakis film, the name of which is completely escaping me. But so this is what Hollywood has been talking about. In a way, this is what Hollywood loves. They love to see somebody who, they love to build people up in lots of magazine profiles, and they like to talk behind that person's back and say things, and then they love to see them fail. When somebody comes to town talking big and they're going to change everything, and then they fall flat
on
their face.
Don't they prefer something like Netflix and Amazon? New players with money who look like they're going to be around long term and are financing and making stuff happen and are succeeding?
Yes, although they like them in a very careful way. They're very careful with them because they're afraid that all of a sudden they're going to basically not have a business of their own. And, you know, as HBO, several executives from HBO once said to me very early on in the Netflix streaming game, they said, you know what, don't tell me you're not a competitor of mine and then outbid me for the content I'm trying to buy. You're a competitor in that regard. So again, yes, we like you, but why do you keep getting into my business? So in this case, it was thank you for helping us finance some very profitable movies, and we all made money on it. You went off on your own. And you realized, wow, it's really hard to do this business, even if you're doing it through mathematical formulas and algorithms, because sometimes the money doesn't come as quickly as you think. And by sometimes, we mean all the time.
So Relativity Media is dead.
Yes, and unfortunately, people like Rowdy Roddy Piper, the wrestler, also passed away.
He was one of the big wrestlers in the 1980s rise of wrestling, pro wrestling. He was one of the biggest bad guys ever. You know, good guys and bad guys. And he died at 61. I have to say that if it's natural causes, which is what it looks like, that's sort of a happy surprise because, frankly, steroid abuse is so rife in the industry. We've seen a lot of guys who are dying from stress on their heart and other things where they're dying at 40s and 50s and 30s and they shouldn't be, but it's because of the drugs that they're using illegally to give themselves bulked up on stuff. It's nice to know that perhaps Rowdy made it to when he did and it was not due to some abuse of steroids. That's such a big problem in that industry. So yeah, you know, he's a shout back to the heyday of wrestling, no doubt about that.
Yeah, look at Lyle Alzado as a perfect example of somebody who was a professional football player, American football player, And he wound up with brain cancer, if I'm not mistaken. And he went on a publicity tour to end all publicity tours about how the drugs, the steroids that he took to play that game caused this cancer. And he just...
Good for him. Yeah, helped change people's minds. Yeah, along with concussions, it really wakes you up to the dangers that your kids in high school face because they feel the pressure. I'm not going to get into the minor league team. I'm not going to make it to the college level if I don't do steroids. Forget get to the pros.
Yeah. Now, also passing away or dying, Lynn Anderson, a country singer of the Smash Hit, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden.
Oh, my darling. You know, you learn something new every day, don't you? Did you read her obit?
I did.
I had no idea how important she was, what a big, influential country star she was. I knew that song, of course. Oh, my darling, I never promised you a rose garden. I knew that her husband didn't want her to record it. He was like her producer slash husband at the time. And he's like, that's a song for a guy. And maybe I'm imagining it, but I think it always sort of did trip me up when she had the line about, you know, I'll give you a big diamond ring. I'm like, well, that's what the guy does. You know, she says, I could promise you things like big diamond rings. And that did kind of, I think, stick in my head a little bit as some of a little, it stopped me for a second. He's like, that's a song for a man to sing. She's like, oh, you're crazy. Huge hit, monster hit. But she had a much bigger career than that, didn't she? Just one song.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, she certainly, what was the first female country artist? She sold out Madison Square Garden. That's not easy, no matter what kind of artist you are.
That's right. And she had the biggest selling album by a female artist. And of course, I think earlier on, sales by Patsy Cline and such weren't registered as well. But she had the biggest official album, you know, in the 70s and lasted for like 25 years till Shania Twain came along. But she also broke through on TV. She was on the Lawrence Welk show. He showcased her for 3 years from 67 to 69. So America knew her. And so when she went out on her own and started to have a hit, she already had a big following because she'd been on TV every week and she did all the talk shows, you know, of course, The Tonight Show and Dean Martin specials, Bob Hope specials. She acted a little. She was even on Starsky and Hutch. And so she was all over the place. Her parents were big successes and she was a big equestrian. She won medals all her life. Even when she was a big country star, even when she was on TV, even when she was touring, she competed on the equestrian level at like the U.S. national and world titles all through her life. She won 8 world titles as an adult while being a big country star.
So what you're saying is, Michael, you and I are effectively slackers.
Absolutely. She also struggled with alcoholism big time, arrested for shoplifting once. She shoplifted a Harry Potter DVD, then punched the arresting officer. I'm going to guess alcohol was involved in that, too.
So wait She'd a second. She was a boxer, equestrian, country singer.
And who drank? Yeah, she had repeated DUIs. She struggled with that all her life. But, you know, kind of a great, great career. And I did not realize what a signal figure she was in country music.
Well, we all knew who Frank Gifford was, and frankly, I should have followed up my Lyle Alzado reference with this story. He was a football player and then a football Hall of Famer, in fact, and he then went on to marry Kathy Lee. No,
that's right.
He went on to Monday Night Football, right? Was it Monday Night Football or just...
Monday Night Football, 27 years in the booth with Dandy Don Meredith. That all three of them were not there the whole time, but he was on for 27 years with Dandy Don Meredith, Howard Cosell. They were as big a draw or bigger a draw than the game. It didn't matter. People tuned in to hear what they would say. They became huge stars and powered Monday Night Football for decades. They were just the biggest thing in the world when it came to professional football. You wanted to be on Monday Night Football. You wanted to have a big moment and you wanted them to talk about you. You know, that's what you wanted if you were a player. But boy, he had a really interesting career too. You know, he was in movies and doing stuff even when in college. He had signed an agent while he was still a pro. He was doing a radio show and a TV show. He did local TV sports coverage even while he was a pro football player. He always had his eye on the long-term plan. He knew even if you're a big success like he was, you know, you got to have a life after football. And he always had that in his back pocket. He did, you know, media deals, lots of endorsements because he was in the New York market, of course. He played for the Giants.
Where he got a $250 signing bonus.
That's right. He was the number one pick in the draft by the New York Giants, and they gave him a $250 signing bonus. Tells you how long ago he started in football. He was in a game that is legendary for football fans, the 1958 game before the Super Bowl that was sort of a title game, and it was won in overtime by the Colts. And it was so everybody had to see that game, and it was such an exciting game. It really helped seal the rise of the NFL into big prominence. It sort of really pushed it up alongside baseball at that time. You know, it made football a big, big deal, a sport that everybody wanted to watch. It was just a real turning point for the game. So a turning point as a player, turning point for the sport, turning point as a broadcaster where he won an Emmy, and a turning point as far as endorsements and positioning yourself to have a career after the game is over. And he had a big concussion too. So this guy did everything, right? He was out for 18 months because of a tackle. he got a concussion and he broke two vertebrae and he had to sit out for 18 months and then he won comeback player of the year when he came back onto the field.
Well, now, okay, so he was a football player that wound up moonlighting in broadcasting. I'm just making a note here. Get contract with New York Giants. Okay, so that's on my to-do list now. Since we're in broadcasting, we should do it the other way around, right?
That's right. That's right. It's been a long episode, hasn't it?
Yes, cool. But my question is, do you think they'll give us $250 for that?
Maybe, maybe.
Okay.
So will our listeners give us a review?
You mean on iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher? Boy, I hope they do. You know, you can actually subscribe to our show in any one of those podcast aggregators. In fact, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can subscribe to our show. You can rate and review the show. And I know today was a little long, but that's because we had 2 weeks of news to cover. And who knew that so much would happen in August? Could you imagine that so much would be happening in August, Michael?
Sure.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe it's just me. But so much happened, in fact, that we have links to all the stories of everything that we've discussed on today's episode, and that can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, ways to follow us. We're on Twitter, at showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, where showbizsandbox is our page, so facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can also write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information, again, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. In fact, Michael, you recommended a book, Kitchens of the Great Midwest?
I did to you off camera, yes.
Yeah, off camera. Well, I hope if there's a camera on me, I better put some pants on. But that said, MGMT figures in that book as well.
Oh, do they? So it's a good book you discovered via Book Filter, really?
Yes, I did. Bookfilter.com, which, by the way, is where we can find some of your work. Bookfilter.com. Where else can we find your work, Michael?
You can find me online at michaelgiltz.com, and I'm always on Huffington Post.
Yes, so if you want to read some of Michael's work about the entertainment industry, you could go there. Some of my work...
And I have one other website. I forgot about that. I do have another website I launched this week. It's called spam.com.
Now, you may have to rewind the episode 10 seconds and figure out how many spams were in that so that you get the whole...
spammy effect.
Yes. You know, you don't want to misspell. You might wind up on some porn site or something like that. We don't want that. It'll probably have one of those, like, you know, covers over it like they have at Cosmo at Rite Aid.
Okay. What about you? Where can we find your stuff?
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Oh, we get to have a show next week.
Yes, we do, in fact.
Oh, well, thank you, Sperling. Maybe it won't be 4 hours long.
I'm thinking 3.5.
Okay.